may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter, people. Sign up for the weekly newsletter, and you can keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. And I'm Jono. Joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, mate.
G'day to you too.
Nice to have you back. Hey, we're in First Samuel, chapter six. There we are.
I have a small confession and a secret to tell you.
Go on.
I'm not signed up to the newsletter.
What?
Yeah.
How do you keep up to date with everything that's going on in Truth to You Land if you're not signed up to the newsletter? Don't you feel like your life is not complete?
I got plenty of things going on.
There's a little niggling thing in the back of your mind. You're thinking, you know, my life is not quite complete. It's because you haven't signed up to the newsletter. You need to do that today. Let's not forget the Hebrew in Israel Facebook page. And a reminder to everyone that that's there as well. The Hebrew in Israel Facebook page. Go to it, like it, and engage.
And, you know, actually, Hebrew in Israel has really grown. We've passed the 1,000 mark. Mm. I have lost a few people the past couple of days. I'm not too sure why. Hope I haven't offended anyone. but also, I know people, you know, they click like just, you know, so they have the reference, and then they'll go back to it and start reading and say, oh, I don't like what this guy has to say. That's perfectly normal. It happens, you know.
I don't really know why. You want to know why they come on and then they go off?
Why?
Because you don't have any sort of Prince Halevi the Fourth action on your Facebook page.
I doubt that.
I'm telling you now, people tune in. People tune in to Light of the Prophets because they want to hear Prince Halevi the Fourth. And when they get to Hebrew in Israel on the Facebook page, and he's not, you don't even have a photo there for Prince Halevi the Fourth.
Yeah, well, I have it's this thing. I don't put pictures of my children on Facebook.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
That's something I'm very careful with because, for example, my father, it's really funny, my father, there's a picture of him, basically my father, my mother, my two younger brothers, and they're holding the pooch they used to have. And someone used that picture, for example, for an article, why ultra-Orthodox are scared from dogs. And my father took a picture, and it was a picture they took... they really mostly, you know, put it, you know, sent it to my brother and I, but they also put it on Facebook. And, you know, so people misuse pictures sometimes. When you put it up on the internet, it's actually public, unless you have a copyright or, you know, you may not use this picture, and if you do, we will sue you and stuff like that. So my father actually contacted the guy who wrote this article and basically said, well, no, you used a family picture, and you should have asked for permission, so please remove the picture. And the guy did. He was very polite about it.
Yeah, very good.
But
yeah.
I'm very, very careful. I mean, I've actually told my relatives, you know, they take pictures of my children and they've put it on Facebook and I told them to remove it. And I just don't put pictures of my children on Facebook. It's part of what I do.
So Prince Halevi the Fourth is very protective of his privacy, and that's fair enough. I can tell you now, actually, Yoel, there are many people on Facebook that don't value their privacy like they should, in my opinion. And there's a lot of people on Facebook that keep messaging me, and they want to know exactly what it is that I believe and about this, that, or the other. And they get very cranky with me if I don't give them specific, detailed answers. And I think, you know,
let me calm down those people for a moment. I don't know what you believe in. Okay, they want to know. I do interviews with you every week. We do a show every week. We talk a lot, and I don't really 100% know what you believe in. Okay,
yeah, because I think Prince Halevi the Fourth is onto something. I think we should be valuing our privacy just a little more than perhaps many of us do on Facebook.
Yeah, I think that you know, I have the same problem. The world I live in. Okay, people in the world I was living in for several years, and the world I live in general all the time, people are very interested in what you believe in, you know. And if you stray from what everyone else believes, then you're a problem.
You're a heretic.
And essentially, you know, I don't really know 100% what you believe in, and frankly, I don't really care. You know, my approach to things is that the Torah has very, very specific laws. If you follow them, and you don't change what they say, then you're okay with me. I'm not bothered by it. And I think this pressure that people have is like, do you fit into a certain group or something like that? I mean, I think that's a very, very unhealthy way of looking at things.
It's unnecessary, you know? And it's not the focus of Truth to You. What you believe, or any of the guests or myself, really, what it is are we presenting information that's making you think? Is it beneficial? Exactly. Does it bless you? Is it, you know, exactly. And I think it does, because a lot of people tune in. And look, for the most part, we have, my goodness, great listeners. We really, really do. And I just want to take the opportunity to thank all the listeners that do send such encouraging comments and messages, whether it be on Facebook or on the website. And if you do have anything to say regarding a program, please, by all means, leave a comment on that particular post. We do appreciate it. And g'day to Dan and Heidi, by the way, who did leave a comment last week on Light of the Prophets.
Okay, so what was the comment? Because I actually, truthfully, it's really funny. I don't have time for anything. I mean, even preparing for Light of the Prophets, I mean, sometimes like 2 hours before the program, I was like, I haven't prepared anything. And I start rushing, like, open up books and everything, and write down notes. And I'm up to my ears with a lot of things. But here's something I really want to share with everyone, because I want people to understand how important is that to focus on the mutual things and not controversial things. You know, discussions in between people. Here's something that's very important. I majored in philosophy in high school. I got an A+ on philosophy in high school, which included mostly Jewish philosophy, but we did venture into studying philosophy of other groups, so we have an understanding of how to think. And I actually majored in several things. Bible studies, Talmud, and Jewish philosophy was one of the big ones as well. And I flunked math, by the way. I'm terrible at math. There's a secret. Okay. Horrible in math. I can see numbers in my head. I can calculate very, very quickly. But when it comes to calculus, when it comes to geometry and stuff like that, I literally stink. I can't do it to save my life. But anyhow, I remember when we were sitting there and we were having the discussion. My teacher wasn't, you know, he was a philosophy teacher, so it's not a lesson, it's a discussion. And he says to us, so, you know, what do you think is the big issue with philosophy? And I raised my hand and said, well, one of the major things is that Torah is not a philosophy, it's a theology. The moment we start involving our philosophies, or the way we think, and our problematic human nature sometimes into something that we understand to be a theology, meaning instead of man trying to figure out God, it's basically God telling man what he actually wants and what he is thinking, we start going everywhere. And the problem is that, you know, our beliefs are essentially our philosophies. And this is why the prophet stood up many, many times and said, well, truly what God wants from you is, they start quoting the Torah. They're just saying, this is the point the Torah was actually making. And these were prophets. And I think the same thing has to be understood here. You know, we come from different beliefs. For example, I just spent the past 2 weeks working with Rico Cortez, and he's a dear, dear friend of mine. Mm. And he and I disagree on a lot of things, but we have the ability to sit together because we focus on the things that make us friends. We focus on the things that we agree on. He and I, yes, we've had arguments. I mean, it's not something that never happens. You know, you have friends. Put a religion aside for a moment. You have friends. Mm. You have a husband, you have a wife, you have children, whatever it is. And you stand there and you have opposing opinions. This is how human beings are. Politics, life, everything. We have opposing opinions. I've had arguments with my brother-in-law. He's very, very stubborn about certain things. But in the end of the day, we hug, we kiss, we sit down and have a drink, and that's basically it. We both don't drink alcohol, by the way. So drink means something else. But
what do you mean you don't drink alcohol? You just made a whole lot of wine.
It doesn't mean I'll drink it.
What?
When I'm sitting with a group and everyone's drinking wine, I'll take a bit. But I don't really drink wine. I don't like alcohol that much. I will have the occasional beer, but even that doesn't really happen that much either. But essentially, what we really, really need to learn to do, and I've said this many, many times, is that we really have to focus on the mutual things and not on the small things that make us fight with one another. And a person who truly loves you and really, really cares about you will not start attacking. What they will do is try to explain it. And this is I think a point that gets lost a lot. I don't think everyone's fighting with one another, but I think there are occasions when people don't stop to think and they don't engage brain and they just start leeching out because they think that, oh, I don't know, whatever beliefs for people have. And it's sad that it happens, but it's human nature. And I think in time most people learn to forgive and forget about a lot of things. You know, that's basically, you know, sharing my relationship with friends that I have, and I have a lot of friends which are believers in Yeshua, a lot of friends that, you know, sit with me and we have conversations. You know what? Here's a funny secret. We never tread on each other's feet because we have one thing in common, which is very, very important, or two things. We all believe in the same God and we all believe in the same Torah. Mm-hmm. You know what? That's enough for us. And I have hundreds of friends from all over the world that are believers in Yeshua, and we're perfectly fine with one another. So same thing here. You know, so I think we have a lot more in common than what people think we do. And so I think that.
Yeah, I was just gonna, so people who appreciate that what we have in common, the common ground that we have is the Torah, is the Tanakh, and that's where we can come together and focus, right? And we don't come together and focus on these things so that we can take breaks in the middle and say, what do you really believe? And what do you really think about this? You know, we don't do that.
Okay, now you're scaring me.
It happens from time to time. But in any case, this is, you know, this is what we're doing. Right now we're doing Light of the Prophets and we're in 1 Samuel. Hey.
Okay, so Halevi the Fourth needs attention for a second. Should just...
Everyone, stop just, and look at Halevi the Fourth.
Well, you won't be able to look at him. I'm just going to walk over
here. No, that's right. That's radio. It doesn't really work, does it? Okay, everyone, stop and listen to Halevi the Fourth.
Just a second.
Okay.
Okay, he's busy with his toys.
He's got toys. He's happy.
Yeah, he looks happy.
He's a happy little Halevi. All right.
Yeah, he has to go to sleep about half an hour, but
no, he has to stay up the next hour while we do this. Here we go. You ready? We're going to start.
Yep.
Now, when we left off, Yoel, we quickly mentioned, of course, in chapter 5, the ark gets captured. The Philistines have it. They move it around from place to place because it's causing all sorts of troubles, and there are tumors or whatever it may be breaking out, and they keep moving it around. Now, we find out that they do this for about 7 months. They're suffering from the plague that Yehovah is bringing upon them for 7 months, and I want to come back to that a little bit later, but it says this, that the Ark of Yehovah was in the country of the Philistines for 7 months, and the Philistines called for the priests. That priest, that now is the word Kohanim?
Yeah, Kohanim. I mean, again, I mentioned this in the past before. Mm-hmm. The word Kohen, you know, say Kohen, you know, like, you know, it's an issue. It's an issue of a position. You know, it's from the term of lechahen, to be in a certain job, in a certain service, position, in a certain whatever it would be.
Mm-hmm. So there he is, and there's another example.
But it's usually a religious position. So it's very interesting. Kohanim are the ones, he usually says Kohanim and Kosmim. And what's very interesting is that these are both temple servers, but there's actually a difference in between them. The Kohanim were actually the people who were the ones who served and gave the sacrifices, whatever it would be. And the Kosmim, the magicians, were really the ones that kind of like knew what the gods want.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the mediums. These are the people who have the direct link with the gods. And in the Torah, for example, we don't have such a thing. There's Kohanim, and there's that's basically it.
That's it.
And there's no other temple servers except for Levites who were mostly there to help. Levites were really mostly scattered in the land with Torah scrolls teaching the people, while the Kohanim were mostly focusing on temple service.
Yep.
So really, actually, it's really funny. Kohanim don't really have a real function these days.
No, they're kind of like we were talking just earlier, and they're as far as their job description is outlined in the Tanakh, they're kind of twiddling their thumbs.
While we the Levites do all the hard work.
That's what it is. So it's your time to shine. So rightfully they go to the priests and the diviners and they say, "What are we going to do with this thing? It's like, you know, tell us how we should send it back to its place."
No, but you're missing out a point. It says, "What shall we do to the Ark of the Lord?" They're not the ones that's going to the Ark of Elohim anymore. They're going like the Ark of Yud-Heh Vav-Heh, and that's like a completely different thing. And they call it the Ark of Elohim, and here they're calling the actually using the name. So the people, at least the people, come to a recognition that, okay, we're messing with something pretty big. But you don't see the masters of Plishtim do anything. The Sarane Plishtim are not even talking with them. Then the people, the laymen, are turning around to the priests and the magicians and saying, "What do we do with this?" The leaders don't want to get rid of it. It's a box made of gold. Why would I want to get rid of that?
This has been going on for 7 months, right?
They don't want to get rid of it because it's the most important object that the Israelites have. And it's made out of solid gold. I mean, it's a wooden box, but it's gold plated, and there's a gold cover cover and everything. Why would I want to get rid of that? This is something worth having and, you know, keeping in our stores. You know, this is ours now. So the people realize something is problematic. And I guess we're going back to the issue of leadership. As I mentioned, the first parts of the book of Samuel is the issue of leadership. So the same thing here. This is leadership of the Philistines. They went to war. They won. They took the ark. They want to keep it. People are saying we're suffering because of the ark. And the leaders are going, no, we're not suffering from anything. You know, Dagon is the great god, blah, 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 blah. You know, we're not suffering from everything. But they're the leaders. They're above everyone. They're probably not suffering from it, but the people are. So this kind of shows you the tension in between the regular people and the leadership. You don't see the leaders until a certain point, and they behave in a certain way in the storyline. So we'll see that in a moment.
Okay. And so what happens is they approach these guys. What are we going to do? And they tell us how we should send it to its place. And so they said, if you send away the Ark of God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means, return it to him with a trespass offering, and then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand is not removed from you. And so
it's very interesting. It's very interesting what they're saying. So first they say, if you are sending, because they don't make the decision. They're saying, if you're going to send it, because they're looking at the leaders who are staying on the other end and going like, if you send the ark, and they're looking at the leaders trying to see if they're going to react, and because they don't know if it's going to happen, the people are putting pressure, but the leaders don't want to. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting they use the term asham. Asham is a sacrifice. You know, there's several types of sacrifices. The ola, which is the burnt offering, it's completely burnt on the altar. Mm-hmm. There's a chatat, and the word of chitui, which means to purge, and also the issue of atoning for the sin. And there's also the asham. And the asham, if you actually look at the asham, that should be chapter 5 in Leviticus, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. It's chapter 6, sorry. And what's interesting, the asham is given when someone steals from someone, either from another person or from the temple. So there, it's kind of funny how it goes, because they say you have to return a gift. So it's very interesting. They stole an item from gold. They return items from gold. But not only do they return items from gold, they return 5 of them. And it makes me think, because first of all, it says that if someone steals from the temple, they give it back and they give a fifth. So here they can't really give a fifth. It's interesting, they give 5. Now, the 5 statues represent the 5 cities of Philistines, but it's kind of funny that it's 5. Now, it makes you wonder, if the ark is a certain weight of gold, maybe they were returning the weight of gold another fifth of that weight, and that was the weight of the statues they replaced, or they sent back.
Mm-hmm. And so what it says is, they say, what is the trespass offering which we shall return to him? And they said, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden rats. Now, just remind me, Yoel, have we spoken about the rats? I mean, does it mention the rats in chapter 5? Did I miss something?
Yeah, it does. It goes like this. Let me open it up.
Because it talks about the tumors in verse 9. It talks about the tumors in verse 12.
So maybe it doesn't mention the rats, and the rats was something mentioned afterwards, because the main focus was on the tumors.
But, yeah, so the tumors are verse 6.
No, it doesn't mention them. So this when it mentions the rats here, it probably explains, for example, verse 11, that there was mehumat mavet b'chol ha'ir,
deadly destruction throughout the city.
That talks about, that's probably the rats, but it doesn't mention the rats. And then afterwards, they actually say, okay, there were rats here.
And so we backtrack and we go, okay, there were rats. And so so much so that it was as significant as the tumors. And so they make 5 golden rats, and they put that in the card, and so they say, here's the 5. According to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for the same plague was on all of you and on your lords. Therefore, you shall make images of your tumors. Now, if they are hemorrhoids, then I'm imagining, I'm imagining, 5 golden butts.
No, if you look at how they symbolize things in the ancient world, these might have been little plates that had the image of a person, dying out, or images of small plates with images of people, with maybe in a certain position that indicates the fact that they're suffering from some intestinal issue or something like that. These were probably because it's a tzalmiot. It says here in Hebrew, v'asitem tzalmei tocholchem. So a tzalem wasn't necessarily just a statue. It might have been a little plate that indicates the story. Like a little piece of gold or something, or a little piece of metal, whatever it would be, has like little images indicating the story of what happened.
Okay. So we're not talking about five golden rats and five golden butts necessarily.
It says it was made from gold, yeah. So they made probably made little plates of gold with a storyline on them.
Okay, all right. Therefore you shall make images of your tumors and images of the rats that ravage the land. There we go. We get a bit more detail there, Yoel, that they ravage the land, and you shall give glory to God, to the God of Israel. Perhaps, there's no guarantees, but perhaps he will lighten his hand from you. Now, here, there's a list of three, Yoel. It says from you, from your gods, and from your land. And, of course, we remember last week that the god Dagon, they put the Ark of the Covenant in the house of Dagon, and Dagon fell down, and he's eventually, the second time, his head and his hands fell off, right?
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, the removal of limbs is an interesting... There's an interesting practice in the ancient world that they used to remove hands, heads, and stuff like that. They actually did it to Sol, and I think I mentioned this last week. I don't remember now, but it's a symbol of defeat, of shame, stuff like that. Hands represent the power. Heads is beheading. But it was very interesting that in the ancient world, for example, in Egypt, they would chisel out the faces or remove the heads. When, for example, there was a pharaoh they didn't like or something like that, or a pharaoh that was causing trouble.
They defaced the statues, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a reason why the head and the hands were removed. But what's interesting is that it might have happened several times when they moved the ark from place to place.
They moved it around from place to place over 7 months putting it in various temples, various gods perhaps. And you're quite right. Yeah, it might have happened several times to their statues.
You know, what's also very interesting here is you pointed this out, that the leaders, the priests, they don't really know the God of Israel. They don't really understand how it works with him. So they're saying, well, maybe it will work. We can't even be 100% sure. So the leaders could be standing there hearing that, and they're like, okay, so you don't even know. So why would I even listen to you?
Yeah, well, I guess they're covering themselves as well. They're like, perhaps this will work, but don't blame me if it doesn't. I'm not going to say that it definitely will, because if it doesn't, I'll be in trouble. So perhaps he will lighten his hand from you, from your gods, and from your land. Why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh? Now, how about that? Harden their hearts. So they know the story. I mean, this is a pretty well-known story, right?
And it uses a lot of the terms which are mentioned in the Exodus.
Yeah, truly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and the Pharaohs harden their hearts. When he did mighty things among them, did they not let the people go that they might depart? Now, therefore, make a new cart, number one. Take two milk cows which have never been yoked, number two. Hitch the cows to the cart, three. And take their calves home away from them, four. There we go. There's simple instructions. Then take the ark of Yehovah and set it on the cart, five, and put the articles of gold which you are returning to him as a trespass offering in a chest by its side, and then send it away. Let it go and watch it and see if it goes along the road to its own territory, to Beth Shemesh. Then he has done us this great evil. But if not, then we shall know. Now, this is interesting, and I want to ask you about this, Yoel. If not, we shall know that it is not his hand that has struck us. It has happened to us by chance.
So, very interesting what they do here. They do kind of like a deviation here, where they're giving signs like, okay, we'll do this, this, and this, and see what happens. So if anyone ever asks about, for example, the concept of nichush, the guess, it's a type of divination, you're basically, you're going to throw a stick in a certain direction, that's the way you go. It mentions Jeremiah, was that Jeremiah, Ezekiel, I can't remember now, where there's a story that says that Nebuchadnezzar was sharpening the arrows, and he was looking at the liver and everything. And there's actually a story filled in by the Jewish sages that he wasn't just sharpening arrows; he was actually firing them and wanted to see to what direction they land. He would just straight up, and whatever direction they land, that's how he would go, because he was trying to see if he's going to go to Ammon or to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing here. You do random things, or you do certain actions, and that's how you make a decision. So here, what they're doing is something slightly different, but they are taking certain actions, and they're going like, okay, we're going to do this, this, and this, and we'll see what happens afterwards, and that's how we make a decision.
So what I want to know also is the concept of something happening by chance. Do we see that elsewhere in the Tanakh, just off the top of your head, as far as you know?
There are a few places where the concept of mikre happens, or the concept of pure chance of it happening, but the Bible always says, like, there's no such thing.
I want to know is something happening to something like this happening to the Philistines? It's a big thing, right? 7 months of all these plagues, the rats, the tumors, so on and so forth. It's pretty significant. Would the ancient Israelites have viewed that as something that might have happened by chance, or how would they have considered an event like that?
Well, I would say something like this. Israelites were deeply religious, at least some of them were. And like today as well, if you're deeply religious, you translate everything as being in the hand of God in some way or another. Mm-hmm. Philistines, on the other hand, you have to remember, these were probably Greeks, so their position about religion is slightly different than the Mediterranean area. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People lived here under the assumption that everything that goes on has something to do with God, all the gods, depending on who they were. The concept of something happening by chance does appear in a few other places. Let me just give a very quick look somewhere, because mm-hmm. I do remember that someone says, you know, mikre hulanu and stuff like that beyond this one.
Let me just, because the reason why I ask is because, and I've heard Nehemiah use these terms to play off against each other, the difference between coincidence and God incidence, as he puts it.
Coincidence and God incidence? We call it mikre and yad Hashem. But the thing is, the Bible more or less assumes that there's no such thing.
As coincidence?
Yeah, the Bible doesn't really...
Doesn't leave room for things just happening, right?
Yeah, I mean, an example... this word doesn't show up that much in the Bible. So the Bible doesn't really like the idea of coincidence.
Sure. So that's what I figured. So I find it interesting, because we see it here with the Philistines. They go, you know, maybe this is God, and this is how we might find out that he will lighten his hand if we do this, that, and the other. Or, you know, maybe we'll just find out that this has happened to us by chance. But I would be interested in if the listeners have any comments in regards to that.
So what's interesting is Kohelet, Ecclesiastics. Mm-hmm. He's the one that uses this word the most. And what's very, very funny is that he doesn't use it in the context of coincidence. If you look at it, for example, there's several verses where he talks about everyone has the same case. Everyone has the same coincidence of the animal and man both die. But he doesn't, Kohelet or Ecclesiastes, he doesn't treat it as coincidence. He says, no, everything's divine. So the mm-hmm. Bible basically assumes there's no such thing as coincidence. And what's the only case we find the concept of coincidence? Philistines.
There it
it's
is.
The only case that happens.
That's what I thought.
Because they're pagans and they're probably Greeks. So the involvement of the gods is a bit more vague.
So there's some insight into the way that they think, right, as far as their religion is concerned. So, interesting.
Yeah, and the Bible, for example, in places like where, for example, you have Psalms, which are lamentation Psalms, they say, why have you forsaken us? But even that's not a coincidence. He doesn't leave us. He just says, you know, I'm going to, it's not as if God says, I'm going to leave you for coincidence. It's not that. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm going to leave you for bad things. I'm going to allow bad things to happen to you. So even when you feel abandoned, he's not abandoned you. He's just making sure you suffer. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and when he, and so it's kind of funny that the Bible basically disagrees with an idea that when God turns away from you, it's not that he's abandoned you, he's allowing other things to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a completely different approach. There is no coincidence in the world. We actually have this saying that if you take the word mikre, mem kuf resh and hey, and you play around with the letters. Now, I don't really believe in this stuff, but they say that if you play with it uses the same consonants as rak me Hashem. Or Rak Me and Hey. Hey usually is written, the letter Hey is usually written to represent the name Hashem, the name. So they play around and they say, oh, there's no mikre, there's rak me Hashem, only from God.
Mm.
So,
if I may suggest another, which I think I heard from Rabbi Eli Cohen, he said, this too is for the best.
Oh, so that's Nachumish Gamzu, used to say, Gamzu le tova. Even that's for the best.
This too is for the best.
Yeah, there were two rabbis who had two different statements. Nachumish Gamzu, and he was called Nachum, the man who says even this. And there was Rabbi Akiva, they used to say something else. I'm not sure I remember what it was.
But was the intention behind it as if to say, you know, this too is something that God has allowed to happen?
Kol man derachmana avid atav avid. Everything that the merciful does, he does for good.
There it is.
That's the statement. It took me a second because it's in Aramaic, so it took me a second to remember. Kol man derachmana derachmana atav avid. Anything that the merciful one does, he does for good.
Amen. Very good. Thank you, my friend. Well, I'm glad that we looked into that. And so anyway, they did so. They took the two milk cows and they hitched them to the cart. They shut up their calves at home and they set the Ark of Yehovah on the cart and the chest with the golden rats and the images of their tumors. And then the cows headed straight for the road to Beth Shemesh. What?
What a pretty sight. Tumors. Yeah. What's the, I can imagine someone, one of the Israelites, going like, picking one of these plates up or whatever. Is like, whoa.
What is going on there? Thanks for the present.
Thanks and, for going back a note saying, thank you for your gift. Whatever it is.
And so went along the highway, lowing as they went. They did not turn to the side. They didn't turn to the right or the left. And the lords of the Philistines went after them to the border of Beth Shemesh. Now, here's a question for Yoel. Now, the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest. Let's stop there for a second. They're reaping the wheat harvest. What time of the year are we looking at?
We're looking somewhere around just Shavuot area.
Yeah, maybe before Shavuot.
Maybe slightly before Shavuot. Maybe just after Shavuot. So you can start positioning things when things happened. So we're talking this battle happened somewhere in the beginning of winter, about the time of now, where we are now in the winter time. Beginning of the winter, and seven months later, they send the ark away. Now, so what's very interesting is a few things. This is winter. They were suffering during the winter from the rats, which is awful. They were having these stomach things, which means, you know, you have to think about it. During the winter, there are more diseases, more infections. So you have to kind of think of what the Philistines were thinking. Well, winter time, you know, rats in the fields. It's, you know.
Rats in the house. I mean, if it's cold. I mean, I remember when we had a mouse plague, and all the mice wanted to do was come inside and get nice and warm.
Exactly. So you have to be a Philistine. You think like we've been through winter time, and we're it's the time where most people suffer from different diseases, and people sometimes die and stuff like that. So I can understand the question marks in the minds of the Philistines. But what basically happened, the Philistines are like, okay, it's winter time, nothing, you know, this is normal for winter time. But then winter time is over, it starts warming up, spring starts leading into summer, and the rats are still here, and we're still suffering from these hemorrhoids. So the people started putting two and two together, and they realized that this is beyond what's going on. But the leaders are like, we don't care, we don't know. And what's very interesting, that they send these out, and they walked all the way up to Beth Shemesh, and the leaders of the Philistines, Saganef Lishtim, were following them.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of indicates that the leaders of the Philistines were not convinced yet. They wanted to see with their own eyes.
And I guess after 7 months, you'd really want to be sure. And so the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping it during the wheat harvest. Now, I suppose that means that perhaps, I mean, we don't really know, but perhaps sometime after Shavuot, after Sukkot, it was captured. It fell into the hands of the Philistines. 7 months later, here we are, they're reaping the harvest of wheat, and it returns in the valley, and they lifted their eyes, and they saw the ark, and rejoiced to see it. And then the ark, the cart, came into the fields of Yehoshua of Beth Shemesh. Is that correct?
Yehoshua Beth Shemeshi, yeah.
Okay. So, and it stood, it stopped. It stopped and said, here I am.
But it stops in front of a big rock.
Does anyone know where that big rock is now?
I actually went searching for it once.
Yeah,
and there were a load of big rocks. I couldn't decide which one it was.
Okay.
I went to Beth Shemesh several years ago, and I went with friends. And my friends actually lived on the outskirts of Beth Shemesh, so we could actually go to the fields. And there was a whole area there where there was an ancient city. And so I started walking around, and it's open fields and everything, and there was actually wheat growing in different places, because this was barley, mostly barley, because this was immediately during Pesach and after Pesach. And I started looking around, you know, and I always remember the story of the ark going to Bet Shemesh, etc. And I saw, and there's loads of these big rocks. Well, what's very interesting, it stops before one big rock, kind of indicating, okay, this is where I want to be. So it's you know, everything that they said that needs to happen happens. And then there's something that happens inside the land of the Israelites where it stops before where God wants the ark to be placed. Now, by the way, I want to link something interesting here. This is the first time the ark is sent back, meaning carried. It's sent back and it's carried on a cart. Mm-hmm. Now, this might have been the reason it went with a cart. It worked perfectly fine. This might be the reason why King David thought that you can carry the ark to Jerusalem on a cart. That was his mistake. This might have been the reason that happened.
Remind me what happened there.
Later on in the book, and I think it's 2 Samuel, King David takes the ark up to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, the first time he does this, he puts the ark on a cart. And Uzzah and Ahio, his brother, walk with this cart instead of having the Levites carry it.
Mm-hmm.
This story, they might have remembered the story, and King David went, well, the Philistines said that we probably can do it as well. Mm-hmm. The difference is the Philistines are not Israelites. That might have been the mistake. That he thought, oh, it's okay because it worked with the Philistines, and we can do the same thing. It's a lot more glamorous if we put the ark on some colorful cart, and we can put flowers around and everything. It looks a lot nicer than having a bunch of people carrying the ark itself. And this might be the story that caused them to make that mistake decades later.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is the incident where the cart stumbles. And now, what was his name? He put out his Uzzah.
Yeah.
And he put out his arm to steady the ark, and God struck him dead immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Which certainly put the fear into David. But you're suggesting that perhaps David thought it would be okay to do it this way, because of this story. Okay.
It's an idea.
That's an interesting connection. No, I think so. Okay. So in any case, the cart came to a stop next to this big rock, and so they split the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to Yehovah. And the Levites took down the ark, and as they should, right? Because only the Levites are allowed to handle it, right?
The Levites are the ones who carry it. But the thing is, the question is, was the ark covered? And this is the next thing that happens. From when the ark was taken to the field, was it taken covered? I assume it was, because it was the whole thing of covering the ark so people don't see it. And when it was uncovered was when it was inside the Holy of Holies.
Yes.
So probably covered, and the Philistines might have left it covered or might have uncovered it, and when they sent it back, put back the cover, but then the next thing happens.
The next thing happens. So the Levites took down the ark of Yehovah and the chest that was with it, in which were the articles of gold, and put them on the large stone. And the men of Bet Shemesh offered burnt offerings and made sacrifices that same day to Yehovah. So when the five lords of the Philistines had seen it, they returned to Ekron that same day. Boy, I bet they were relieved. And these are the golden tumors which the Philistines returned as a trespass offering to Yehovah. One for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, one for Ekron. And the golden rats, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both fortified cities and country villages, even as far as the large stone of Avel, on which they set the Ark of Yehovah, which stone remains to this day in the field of Yehoshua of Bet Shemesh, which you went looking for, but couldn't be decisive on which one it was. But then it happens, Yoel. Then he struck, now I've got an asterisk here, I got to ask you about this. Then he struck the men of Bet Shemesh because they had looked into the Ark of Yehovah. He struck, 50,070 men of the people, and the people lamented because Yehovah had struck the people with a great slaughter. What do you have?
So first of all, the word struck appears four times. There's shock here. What do you mean he struck them? So he uses the word struck four times in different variations. Now what's very interesting is that it says, Vayach ba'am shivim ish chamishim elef. The construction here is completely off. He struck 70 people, 50,000 people. It doesn't say, for example, 70 and 50,000. It says 70, and then it says 50,000 in a disjunctive way. There's nothing connecting them to one another. So there's a lot of different opinions what this actually means. Well, first of all, we have to remember 50,000 people is a big city. It would have wiped out the entire area. So they say, so there's different opinions what it means. Some people say 70, really who people who died were 70 people, and the 50,000 is an overall number of people that have been hurt throughout the wars with the Philistines. Some people say it was 70 people who were equal to 50,000 people. Some people say it was the 70 elders of Israel and another 50,000 people of Israel afterwards in general as well. There are different opinions.
I've got another thing I've got to ask you about this, Yoel, because I have, maybe you can make sense of this because it seems it's very curious. So I've got an asterisk, and I have an asterisk every now and then in my New King James Study Bible, and I follow it down, and it says 6:19, or he struck 70 men of the people and 50 oxen of the man.
So they want to say the word elef, but elef again. The word elef, when it's a number,
is there a possibility here?
I mean, let's try to expand on this. What do you think they actually mean in this comment?
Well, this is what I mean. I don't know if it's possible to do in the Hebrew, but this is what I'm imagining. If that is more correct, and I like to think that 50,000 seems extreme, but I can imagine that 70 men gathered around to lift the cover and look inside, and that they were struck dead by Hellfire because they were doing what they weren't allowed to do. Now, maybe there was one particular guy who said, hey, I've got a bright idea. Hey, let me be the one to open it. Let me look in there first. Maybe his livelihood was also devastated, that his oxen, maybe he had 50 oxen. He might have been an important guy, and his oxen was devastated. Maybe he was the instigator. That I can deal with. I just don't know if that's a possibility in the Hebrew.
No, so it isn't, because it says, Vayach ba'am shivim ish. The word ish means man. Shivim ish means 70 men. Mm-hmm. And then it says, chamishim elef ish. The construction there actually means 50,000 people, 50,000 men. So it doesn't really work unless you want to say elef is really not 1,000. Like they try to say, for example, with the Exodus, it's not 1,000, it's 50 units or something like that, which comes out to like, here will be like 500 people or something like that. But this doesn't work. It doesn't work with the Hebrew. The word elef doesn't necessarily mean, you know, elef, the exact term they're trying to say. It means, trying to say
oxen,
that it means
50 oxen. Oxen.
No, like, no, you not know. Oxen. No, no. The word for, in the book of Samuel, for oxen, the word elef or aluf is never used. So it doesn't work with the style of the text itself. But what they're trying to say is the word, there's an explanation where they're trying to deal with the numbers of the Israelites. So it says 60,000 or 600,000. And they try to say that it's not 600,000. It's 600 of 600 soldiers or something like that. So you try to explain it here. It's not 50,000. It's 50 soldiers or something like that. Again, these things are completely theoretical. I have not been convinced that this stuff is, that it's correct. But that, I mean, again, it might have been that there were two different traditions. It might have been that what I said, there were 70 people struck on the spot, but there were 50,000 people added. It might be that the text we have here is corrupted, and then the original text said something else. I don't have access to the Book of Samuel from the Dead Sea Scrolls, but if someone actually has access to see what it says there, that might actually help out a bit. Maybe correction.
We'd be interested to hear listeners' comments on that. If you have any additional information there, it's certainly a curious verse, 1 Samuel 6:19. But 20, the men of Bethshemesh said, who is able to stand before this holy? I mean, you would too. You'd be like, and apparently there's some men left. I mean, 50. Anyway, they're upset. And to whom shall it go up from us? So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiryat Yarim?
Yarim.
Yarim. And what does that mean, by the way?
It could be the Yarim has to do with the word forest or something like that. So it was an air forest area. And actually, the area it's considered to be Kiryat Yarim was a forest area. So it might be that.
Okay, so they're saying the Philistines have brought back the Ark of Yehovah. Come down and take it up with you. And then the men of Kiryat Yarim came took the Ark. Yarim. Came and took the Ark of Yehovah and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill. He consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the Ark of the Lord.
There's a man called Elazar. They sanctify him to take care of the Ark. What's very interesting is that you ask yourself a question: so why isn't the Ark being taken care of by a priestly family or something?
That's what I'm wondering.
So first of all, we have to understand that the priests have been devastated; that their temple has been destroyed. There's nowhere for the Ark to be. And it could be that the priests were realizing, okay, we made a big mistake here. We're not worthy of dealing with the Ark at the moment. So they just chose someone else, a righteous family maybe, to take care of the Ark, because the priestly family...
But is it possible that Abinadab and his son Eleazar are Levites? I mean, do we know?
We don't know, but it could be. There's a possibility that they're Levites. It is possible.
Because it's not just that these guys look after it. They tend to it. But we find out in the next verse, it's there for 20 years, Yoel.
Yep. And that's what happens with the Ark for a while. It travels from a house to a tent, from a tent to a house, representing the lack of order that was going on at the time. I mean, King David himself, there's a lot of similarities here as well, because King David, for example, takes the Ark with a wagon. They can't do it. They take it off. They put it in someone else's house. It sits there for a while. And only then King David takes it out from that house and takes it to Jerusalem. When he takes it to Jerusalem, he puts it in a tent until he wants to put it down. And at this point, when Shiloh is destroyed, part of the tabernacle is one place. The Ark is in another place. There's an altar in a third place. It's a bit of a mess.
Sure. So in any case, so here we are in chapter 7, verse 2. And it says, and so it was the Ark remained in Kiryat Yearim.
Yearim,
a long time. It was there 20 years in all the house of Israel lamented after Jehovah. Now, the interesting thing up to that point between verse 6,
Your translation says lamented?
It says lamented. I've got lamented. They lamented.
Okay, so that's a mistake. There are places where the root of Nehi and Naha are similar. There's actually a mistake in your text. It actually means they followed. Lanuha. Actually, it's not lanua with an ayin, it's naha, linhot, after something, which means to follow, but massively, like really follow without discrepancy.
Mm-hmm.
So your translation has a mistake, but that has to do with identification of the root, and they made a mistake in identifying the root there. Or just, maybe they identified the root, but they misunderstood what the root means. That's number one. Also, this whole thing of 20 years and everything, the stories here work in cycles of 40 years, 20 years, 40 years, 20 years. If you notice that, we have that a lot in the storylines. I can't say it's literally 20 years. It might be...
So it could be an estimation of saying, like, you know, there's a dozen of such and such over there or whatever it is. It's an estimation. Exactly.
It's rounding up to a larger number. For example, it might have been 17 years or 18 years, and they rounded up to 20.
Or 22. Might have been 22 years.
Exactly. But, 22 to 20.
Sure. So now I've just noticed also, Yoel, from chapter 4, if I'm not mistaken, from chapter 4 right through to chapter 7, verse 2, we haven't heard anything from Samuel. At all. But here in verse 3, he enters the story once again.
Yeah, he re-enters the story. And because he's not been involved in this shenanigan, basically.
Yeah,
he's not involved in this. He didn't tell them to go out to war. He didn't tell them that God's with them about this battle. He was completely out of it. He had nothing to do with any of this.
And actually, the whole reason why this happened, you could really pin it on Eli's sons, and now that whole situation is taken care of. Eli has passed, the sons have passed, and now we're getting back to business, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so it says, then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, if you return to Jehovah with all your heart, then put away your foreign gods. They had foreign gods, yeah, well, put away your foreign gods, the Ashtoreths, from among you, and prepare your heart for Jehovah, and serve him only, and he will deliver you from the land, from the hand of the Philistines. So even after 20 years, the Philistines are still a threat. So the children of Israel will put away the Baals and the Ashtoreths. They had them both, and served Jehovah only. And Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mitzvah, and I will pray to Jehovah for you. So they gathered together at Mitzvah. Then, now, Yoel, they drew water and poured it out before Jehovah. What is the significance of that?
So the only other case we have something similar to this is when King David poured water for God when they brought the water from the well in Bethlehem. He said, "Who will let me drink from the well of Bethlehem?" And three warriors broke into the siege there and got the water. He said, "These men endangered themselves, so he poured the water for God." There's no commandment in the Torah to do this, so we understand this as being a symbolic thing that they pour their hearts. And it says, "Shifchika mayim nibech nochach b'nei Hashem." It's like, pour your heart like water before the presence of God. So it's the same thing here. So it's mm-hmm. a symbolic action. This wasn't really a sacrifice.
Okay. And so they do this, and they fast for a day, and they and said there, "We have sinned against Yehovah." And now it says Samuel judged the children of Israel at Mitzpah. Now, what does that mean exactly?
It probably, you know, the thing is that to judge someone means he probably stood there and, you know, told them what the right way to go is, and he might have also took care of iniquities in the nation, like, for example, trials in between people. But probably mostly what he meant was he judged, I mean, he showed that he's a leader. He put mm-hmm. his foot down as well. He stood right there. They accepted him as their leader. And he was also probably able to tell them what they have to correct. So he was also kind of like, quote-unquote, preaching to the people about mm-hmm. what has to be done as well.
Fair enough. And now when the Philistines heard that the children of Israel had gathered together at Mitzpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And when the children of Israel heard of it, they were afraid of the Philistines. So the children of Israel said to Samuel, "Do not cease to cry out to Yehovah, our God, for us, that he may save us from the hands of the Philistines." Now, this is a totally different thing to what we see a few chapters ago, right? I mean, a few chapters ago, they're like, bring the magic ark. And this time it's different, right? What do they do?
Well, this time it's different because they have Samuel involved. Mm. There's a contrast here. It's contrasted to the previous verses. First of all, this time they weren't even preparing for war. Last time was, "We're going to prepare for war. We're going to battle with them and everything." This time they're not even gathering to prepare for war. War is coming upon them now because they gathered, because the Philistines misunderstood. But this time Samuel's involved. So it's like there's a contrast. Here you're not prepared for war, you're anyhow going to win.
Mm.
Because this time you're listening to God, this time you're following his instructions, so yes. This time you're going to win. So it's a contrast of what we had the previous verses.
They put away their foreign gods, and they said to Samuel, "Continue to cry out, don't cease to cry out to Yehovah, pray for us that we may be saved from the hand of the Philistines." There's no bring the magic ark and let's treat God like the magic genie in the lamp. They're saying to Samuel, pray for us as we face these guys. And Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it as a whole burnt offering to Yehovah. And then Samuel cried out to Yehovah for Israel, and Yehovah answered him. Now as Samuel was offering the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to the battle against Israel, but Yehovah thundered with a loud thunder. Is this what you've got in the Hebrew? He thundered with a loud thunder?
So it doesn't use the word thunder. It says, and he thundered with a loud sound or a loud voice. But it probably means that there was a big storm suddenly showed out of nowhere. And it's kind of interesting because with Samuel, we have twice the changing of weather. Because, for example, here a sudden storm comes out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we have another case later on where he says, well, If God is with me, he does it in the next chapter, if God is with me, then let it rain, and it does.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a symbol. Samuel suddenly, again, like Joshua, like Moses, that nature suddenly changes because they show up.
And it works against the enemy because all of a sudden, because of the loud thundering or whatever it was, they became confused, and so they were overcome before Israel. But it just reminds me of something I was thinking of and talking with someone earlier in the week, and maybe you can think of something. I mean, I know I put you on the spot a lot, Yoel, but maybe off the top of your head, I know that Baal, many of the Baal statues and figurines that have been found by archaeologists.
Oh, yes. I know exactly what you're alluding to now.
They've got lightning bolts in their hands, right? And lightning is a big thing.
So Baal was the thunder god. I mean, if you go mm-hmm. to the Phoenician stories, for example, the tales of Baal and Moth, which I should have a copy of them somewhere in my library. Well, I got that one, but I want the other one. Anyhow, no, I'm just looking at my library for a second. Took me a while to find this copy. But the whole idea is that they always saw Baal as being the thunder god, the god of rain. And so now that, you know, they put away the Baalim. Now, again, Baal, I mean, there was different types of Baal. There was even a point, and we'll see it later on, that people confuse Baal with the God of Israel. Even great people confuse Baal with the God of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And here, suddenly, they get rid of the Baalim, they put him away, and they don't have Baal anymore, but thunder still strikes. There's suddenly thunder in the heavens. So they kind of realize, oh, okay, we thought Baal is the one that controls the thunder and lightning, but we're wrong, it's someone else. So there's you're right, there's a symbolic issue here.
So it's interesting, isn't it? And just curiously, off the top of your head, as far as you know, is there an incident where Yehovah actually uses lightning specifically? Do we see? I mean, I know on Mount Sinai, if I remember correctly, I think there is there's some kind of a lightning display, if you like. But is there a use specifically of lightning by Yehovah for a particular purpose, maybe against the enemy or something or other? Because I know we read about instances where there is hail that comes upon the enemy. A couple of times we read about that. Here we hear about a thundering, a loud noise. Can you think of anything?
So there are quite a few places, for example, Psalms and descriptive places where it describes, you know, God showing up with thunder and things like that. But if we have an lightning? Actual case of, no, also lightning, for example, there's a few Psalms that do a lot with the issue of lightning when God shows up. But it probably all alludes back to the issue of, whatchamacallit, of Mount Sinai.
Yeah, because I'm just curious, like using lightning as a tool of judgment or punishment or some sort of attack upon the enemies, because, you know, they do associate that with the Baals, but...
So there is one theory I once heard, and this was an idea I once heard, that when Elijah was on Mount Carmel, he was battling the prophets of Baal. So one of the ideas I once heard was that when it says fire came from the sky, it wasn't fire, it was a lightning strike that hit specifically the altar and caused the fire to start burning. But it was deliberately used as lightning because it was, again, mocking the followers of Baal. Because you have to remember, lightning was kind of recognized as being type of fire. Because anyway, lightning strikes in an open field, it causes, if the field is dry, it starts burning.
It causes fire, yeah.
So that might be, but again, I can't prove it. I mean, I vaguely remember
looking at... So that's not a stretch, though. That's not a stretch of the imagination. I think that's a fair conclusion to come to, though it is speculation, and it's fair that you should make note of that. But that's very good. The other one might be the plague where the hail falls from the sky, and it says hail mingled with fire. Perhaps it might have been hail and lightning that caused fire.
No, that wouldn't work, because it says that the fire was burning inside the hail.
Does it really?
If we go back to Exodus very quickly. But on the other hand, you know, there was noise, so there must have been during that plague, there must have been thunder and lightning and stuff like that to scare the Egyptians. But let me very quickly, because I remember it says the fire was burning inside.
So Exodus chapter 9, verse 13, Yehovah said to Moses, "Rise early."
And there was hail, and fire was burning inside the hail.
Really? Wow. So could that have been not ice hail, but it might have actually been maybe volcanic fallout, for example?
Yeah, but this was also hail. I mean, there's a difference in between hail and volcanic eruption. First of all, I think the closest volcano to Egypt is across the sea. Now, unless we take that theory, then in the 15th or 16th century BC, there was a big volcano eruption that some people try to link to the Exodus. It might be related, but I seriously doubt it.
That's really interesting. So the fire was in the hail. Well, anyhow,
I will say one thing. A couple months ago, during the last winter or something, it was hail falling in the United States, and people sent me pictures of these things were like as big as from tennis balls all the way to small basketballs and stuff like that. Huge things, and caused a lot of damage.
Yeah, I remember being in a hailstorm down on the northern beaches of Sydney, and we had a hailstorm with hail, you know, cricket ball sized hailstones, and they went through tin roofs. I mean, that was some really, really serious stuff, can do a lot of damage. But in this case, loud thunder which caused confusion, and says the men of Israel went out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and drove them back as far as below Bet-Kar. Where's Bet-Kar? Obviously, it's close to, where are they, Mizpah?
I'm looking for the Bet-Kar. So it's probably in the area of Mizpah, where Bet-Kar is. I mean, if you want to check in the map, I can.
Can't be that far anyhow.
It's probably not that far away from that area.
Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mitzvah and Shen and called its name, and now this is what you were saying earlier on last week, called its name Ebenezer, saying, thus far, Yehovah has helped us. Now,
so by the way, it says Evan Ha'ezer, so it works like this, Vayikra et Shema Evan Ha'ezer, and he called it Evan Ha'ezer, the rock of help.
Mm-hmm.
And it plays basically in Yeshua, Vayomar Adhena Azaranu Adonai. So when they were, he named it, he was using the same sound or the same root, Azaranu Ezel. So he called it the rock of helping up to here, God helped us.
Mm-hmm.
Or use that translation, for example. We mentioned the Evan Ezel. We mentioned that last week. Was it when they lost the battle, wasn't it?
Yeah, because it makes mention of the in chapter of the place in chapter 4.
Yeah, I just looked at
it. So I've got chapter 4, verse 1. Now, Israel went to battle against the Philistines and encamped at Ebenezer.
Yeah, okay, so we have a chapter 4 and chapter 5.
Okay, but it wasn't actually, and you pointed out that it wasn't actually named that until this point here, and here it is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come anymore into the territory of Israel, and the hand of Jehovah was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel, Yoel. The cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel from Ekron to Gath, and Israel recovered its territory from the hands of the Philistines. Also, there was peace between Israel and the Amorites.
Now, so there's a few things here. First of all, there wasn't peace. Well, it could be that at times of Samuel there was peace until Samuel died, and then the Philistines, their big voodoo witch is gone, and we can start attacking again. That might be the mindset they were in. So then King David shows up.
Yep.
But also, you know, but we do know that there were still attacks and there were still wars going on, because it doesn't make sense. Saul continued fighting against the Philistines, so I don't really understand this statement. It might be that what he meant was that the Philistines were slightly weakened, or that every time the Philistines tried to attack, they lost the war. They were not, they did not come in the border of Israel, but it might have been that they wouldn't come near the border, but there was still rivalry in between them.
Where it says they were subdued, perhaps it means, you know, from that point on, they were on the back foot. We had the advantage. Exactly.
Okay. Now, what it means that there was peace in between Israel and the Amorites is a very, very strange statement. But it could be that the Amorites, which was one another group of nations, because Amorites sometimes is a general name for all the nations who live in the land.
Mm-hmm.
And some might say, oh, this is literally the Amorites. But what it means is that the Amorites saw what happened to the Philistines and went, okay, we surrender. And they went and made peace with Israel.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and for a time. And Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. He went from year to year on a circuit to Bet-El, Gilgal, to Mitzvah, and judged Israel in all those places. But he always returned to Ramah, for his home was there, and there he judged Israel, and there he built an altar to Jehovah. Do we know where that is?
So Ramah is understood to be, again, Ramataim, where his family originally came from.
Mm-hmm.
Ramah is actually, you can actually see Ramah from Jerusalem. There are these two hilltops, and actually one of them, there's a place called Nabi Samuel, where there's a tradition that's where Samuel was buried, and they say he was buried in Ramah, and there's these two hilltops you can actually see from Jerusalem, which are probably the place called Ramah, because it really sticks out. They're not just two hilltops out of nowhere. It's a place that really, really sticks out.
Okay.
It's a very, very high area.
Is there a traditional place where the altar might have been?
These things, there are very few actual altars which were discovered. I mean, Joshua's altar is one of the big ones. Mm. There were two altars discovered. There was an altar discovered in Beersheva, or Tel Beersheva, actually. There was one discovered in Tel Arad, and there's a base of the altar discovered in Tel Dan. There's a few Canaanite altars which were discovered, but the number of altars, Israelite altars, which were discovered are very, very, very small.
Fair enough.
I don't think anyone's ever found this one.
Fair enough. Well, this in any case, Yoel, you know, we went through two chapters. How about that? We got to the end of chapter 7, and next week, it is chapter 8, a very significant chapter. This is the chapter where Israel demands a king.
Yeah, well, the reason we were able to finish off two chapters is because I let you zoom through. I could have stopped you some. I could have told you, okay, no, we have to still stall on this, we have to stall on this, but I let you go because, you know, you've been complaining lately that we're taking too much time with you.
And I mean, you know, little Prince Alevi the Fourth has to go to bed, right?
Oh, very. Actually, he should have been in bed half an hour ago, but I'm letting him play. The only thing I can't is, why does he pull his trousers off every time? His trousers off for no reason. It's cold, honey. Listen, it's really, really cold. Why do you take the trousers off?
There it is. You've been listening to Truth to You with Jono. It's on, what are we? Light of the Prophets. Hebrew in Israel with Yoel Ben Shlomo. The Facebook page is Hebrew in Israel. Thank you for listening, my friends. Go to the Facebook page, Hebrew in Israel, and like it. We will keep you up to date as soon as the Hebrew in Israel website becomes available. That is happening. Just a matter of time. But until next week, dear listeners, we're going to be in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Israel demands a king. And until then, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom. Kol tov.
What do you mean he's pulled his pants off?
He keeps on doing it. He takes his trousers off. Every time he pulls, at one point, he decides, I don't want my trousers anymore. I'm taking them off. You know what? I'm putting them back on and you're going to bed. I'm going to put them back on and you're going to bed.
Thank you, little Halevi, for being such a good boy.
Stop putting toys in your mouth.